On this episode of Skeptico, consciousness researcher Dr. Stuart Hameroff.
Your understanding of the quantum mechanics of the neuron really stirs up a lot of angst among the AI singularity crowd.
To look at our brain as 100 billion simple switches or gate, a synapse is a gate, is a tremendous, it's an insult to neurons. The bit with the AI and the singularity, there's actually a couple points of friction here. One is, as I said, I spent 20 years, the 70s and 80s basically, studying microtubule information processing. So the AI approach would be, you know, roughly speaking, that a neuron fires or doesn't. It's roughly comparable to a bit, one or zero. More complicated than that, but roughly speaking. And I was saying, no, each neuron has roughly 10 to the 8th tubulins switching at roughly 10 to the 7th per second, giving 10 to the 15th operations per second per neuron. And if you multiply that by the number of neurons, 10 to the 11th, you get 10 to the 26th, something like that, operations per second per brain, whereas AI is looking more at neurons firing or not firing, you know, 1,000 per second, 1,000 synapse, something like 10 to the 15th operations per second per brain.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, consciousness researcher Dr. Stuart Hameroff. Today we welcome Dr. Stuart Hameroff to Skeptico. Dr. Hameroff is professor emeritus in the departments of anesthesiology and psychology at the University of Arizona, where he also serves as the director of the Center for Consciousness Studies. Dr. Hameroff, thank you so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
You're welcome, Alex. It's nice to be here.
Well, you know, there's so many interesting topics I wanted to talk to you about, but I thought we might start with your credentials, because as I was looking through some of your research in preparation for this interview, I ran across a comment from a blogger along the lines of, isn't this guy just an anesthesiologist who's playing around with quantum mechanics and consciousness stuff as a hobby? Strange sort of hobby. So anyways, I kind of just laughed that off because, I mean, you have a distinguished academic career, a list of publications as long as my arm with some of the world's leading physicists. But then I ran across a similar comment again, and it got me thinking about really the deeper issue of consciousness studies and the problem that I think a lot of folks have in figuring out who's really qualified to talk about this stuff. I mean, we see philosophers throwing in their opinion, neurologists, physicists. So do you want to talk a little bit about this field in terms of who's really qualified to venture into this area and say what consciousness is all about?
Well, I don't presume to judge anybody. I think Ditchdigger might figure it out just out of luck or because he or she is motivated. So that's not the point. I think if you have a good approach, you should use it. Now, my approach has been twofold. Number one, I got interested in microtubules inside cells back when I was in medical school and got intrigued by the idea that they were molecular-scale information processing devices, and followed that for about 20 years, modeling microtubules as classical computers, but then ran into the question of how would that explain consciousness, and that's when I got into the quantum stuff. Now, at the same time, in parallel, I was studying the mechanism of anesthesia, and I am an anesthesiologist, but I'm also an academician, and my research has to do with a number of things, but anesthetic mechanisms, and consciousness. And I think anesthesia, understanding how anesthetics actually act, is a tremendous tool or lever to get at the problem of consciousness. And that's been my strategy. And it turns out that anesthetics act strictly by quantum level forces, very weak London forces, in phases or regions inside proteins which are conducive to quantum processes. So my research has led me into the quantum realm, working with Roger Penrose, but also because anesthesia acts strictly by quantum forces.
I think the other thing that throws people is you do have a way of making this stuff almost understandable. I mean, when we get into quantum mechanics, it just gets so confusing so fast. I love, by the way, the fact that you often use that Richard Feynman quote in your presentations, that anyone who claims to understand quantum mechanics is either lying or crazy. I think that's a great disarming way to start this. But you do seem to have a way of simplifying this and making it more accessible. Has that been one of your goals in communicating this?
Well, it's been a necessity because, as I said, I was working on classical information processing and microtubules inside neurons for about 20 years and never considered quantum effects. You know, the basic idea of that was that, you know, where most people in AI, for example, consider the brain as 100 billion or so individual switches, neurons firing and not firing, each of which is fairly simple, comparable to a bit or an operation in a computer. But I realized that individual cells are incredibly complicated. And if you look at something like a paramecium, a single cell which swims around, finds food, finds a mate, has sex, can learn, it doesn't have any synapses. It's just one cell. So I thought you had to look at a lower level, and the microtubules seemed to be perfectly designed computers. But I thought they were classical computers until I ran into what's now known as the hard problem, and I read Penrose's book about quantum physics and was intrigued, didn't really understand it all. I had studied physics, but not really quantum physics. And so I, you know, beginning in the early 90s, I started studying it, and I had to try to put in a way that made sense to me, and then in my writings and talks and whatnot, I try to explain it the way I understand it, and it doesn't involve a whole lot of math, or it's more conceptual, which is actually the Penrose approach. He's very more conceptually oriented, even though, of course, he has all the mathematical tools, and he puts it in a way that I think is understandable, and then I put my own interpretation on it, and so it's how I can understand it. I just put out there the way I look at it.
I think it's great, and it does help a lot of people. At the same time, maybe you want to dig into this a little bit more. You just touched on it. Your view of things and your understanding of the quantum mechanics of the neuron really stirs up a lot of angst among the AI singularity crowd. Tell us a little bit about that controversy, and what really underlies that is that it doesn't just chip away at the whole AI singularity thing, but it really gets to this whole idea of whether we are just our brain or whether we're something more.
It's okay to say we are our brain, but we got to understand what our brain is. And to look at our brain as 100 billion, you know, simple switches, and that's, you know, an oversimplification. But as neuron as a fundamental switch or gate, a synapse as a gate, is a tremendous, it's an insult to neurons. It's like, it's just not that simple. And if you study biology, you realize that. But of course, if you study, a lot of biologists get bogged down in the details and then lose the big picture. And, you know, they see the information processing in a cell as a minestrone soup of chemicals when they're ignoring the solid state system in the microtubules. But the bit with the AI and the singularity, there's actually a couple points of friction here. One is, as I said, I spent 20 years, the 70s and 80s basically, studying microtubule information processing. So the AI approach would be, you know, roughly speaking, that a neuron fires or doesn't. It's roughly comparable to a bit, one or zero. More complicated than that, but roughly speaking. And I was saying, no, each neuron has roughly 10 to the 8th tubulins switching at roughly 10 to the 7th per second, giving 10 to the 15th operations per second per neuron. And if you multiply that by the number of neurons, 10 to the 11th, you get 10 to the 26th, something like that, operations per second per brain, whereas AI is looking more at neurons firing or not firing, you know, 1,000 per second, 1,000 synapses, something like 10 to the 15th operations per second per brain. So I was, you know, saying, no, the information processing capacity is 10 to the 11th more, almost squaring, you know, what you guys are saying, strictly, you know, looking at the level of microtubule information processing, and that's without even bringing in the quantum business. So that alone was pushing the goalposts way, way downstream, or, you know, into the future, smaller in terms of hardware, in which case you get into quantum effects anyway. So I, you know, in the 80s, I was mostly going to neural network meetings and some AI meetings, and saying this, and now I was pretty unpopular because it was making their job much more difficult in terms of attaining brain equivalence. But that was strictly on the basis of number crunching. Now, if you then bring in the quantum effect, that and then I read Penrose's book, The Emperor's New Mind, which was obviously, I think, a slap in the face at AI for completely different reasons based on Gödel's theorem and non-computability, saying that consciousness and understanding was not just computation, it was something else. And what that else was involved something to do with quantum physics. So when I teamed up with Roger, we had two issues with AI. One was just the capacity, moving it down to the molecular level, and two was the whole quantum business. So, we were and probably remain fairly unpopular with AI. I gave a talk at the Singularity Summit a couple years ago, and I got somewhat of a cold reception. I enjoyed doing it, but what we're saying is in conflict with a major premise of AI and singularity. Right. So there is some friction there. And, it's not that I'm being antagonistic. I'm just saying what I believe.
Right. I want to get back to that mind equals brain thing. But I think the way that I want to approach it is to talk a little bit about near-death experience science. It's something that you've delved into, written a little bit about. And it's something that we've certainly covered a lot on this show. Because to me, it seems like we can get some real-world data out of that research that seems to get at the heart of some of these questions about consciousness. But before we dig into that, I wanted to comment or ask you to comment on a paper I read of yours on near-death experience, where it sounded like it was written to anesthesiologists, and the idea was maybe we need to take more care in, I guess, preserving or understanding the near-death experience in that it's significant to people, and we need to do everything we can to understand it and maybe foster it.
Yes. The near-death experience stuff has been around for a while. Actually, it goes back thousands of years, people reporting this phenomenology. And then it's been almost 15 years ago, two studies in Europe, one by Peter Fenwick's group in England and one by Pim van Lommel in Netherlands, looked at hundreds of patients who had cardiac arrests, and they interviewed them, they were resuscitated. And afterwards, about 17% reported this near-death experience with very, very similar phenomenology of white light and a tunnel and a sense of calm and visits from dead relatives and, in some cases, floating, outside their body, the so-called out-of-body experience. And this was very, very consistent among all these patients in these two different studies. But again, it was all subjective, and people could kind of picked it apart and this and that. Anyway, about 2 years ago now, two studies came out measuring brain activity at the end of life. One from Dr. Chawla at George Washington University. He's an anesthesiologist and a critical care guy who also does palliative care. So he takes care of dying patients, and he had a series of patients who. From whom support was withdrawn. They were on life support. They were terminal. They were pretty much hopeless and not mentating. They weren't conscious or didn't appear to be conscious. And they and their families, the families and the doctors decided to withdraw support, which is not uncommon. And so they did. But Chawla put the brain monitor that we use in anesthesia, actually there's several of them, which measures depth of anesthesia. And just in a rough sense, they give you this number, 0 to 100, where awake conscious would be between 80 and 100. And anesthetized patient should be between 40 and 60. And below that is insult to the brain in one way or another. So these patients were all at anesthetic or sub-anesthetic levels to start with. And as they withdrew the ventilation and the cardiac support, their heart slowed down, eventually stopped, and their blood pressure dropped. And the number, the brain activity number, dwindled down towards zero in almost all these cases, or near zero. But then when the heart had stopped or was about to stop or close to stopping, there was a burst of activity in the brain monitor up to conscious levels. At about 80, which lasted anywhere from 90 seconds to 20 minutes in one case. And then the patients, you know, died, and then it abruptly stopped again. And Chawla, in his article, suggested that, you know, maybe this was the correlate of the so-called near-death experience, except obviously these patients did die. And perhaps had they come back, they would have said, hey, I saw the white light, the near-death experience, and so forth. So in one of these instances, they analyzed the raw data and to how this number was derived, and they found that it involved gamma synchrony, EEG, 30 to 90 hertz electrical activity that correlates with conscious awareness. And so he suggested that this was some indicator that this was conscious activity or something like it that could be the near-death or maybe even out-of-body experience. So, and then there was another study in the anesthesia literature in a journal called Anesthesia and Analgesia from a group from Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle. And David Aoyang was the first author, and they reported on three patients for what's called post-cardiac death organ donation, where, again, hopeless terminal patients are basically they allow them to die just for the same reasons they were hopeless and terminal and not conscious. And then soon after death, they take their organs for organ transplantation. And so they monitored these patients, and they saw the exact same thing in terms of when the awareness number dwindled to zero, there was then this sudden burst of activity up to near 80, indicating awareness that it lasted minutes, and then it went away. So I wrote a letter to the Anesthesia and Analgesia. Now, in this paper, they didn't mention the possibility that it was a near-death experience. They just said, we saw this activity. We don't know what it is. Maybe it's the last gasp of neuronal depolarization is due to potassium buildup. An explanation which doesn't make sense for a lot of reasons, but they didn't address that it was a near-death experience possibility, the possibility that it was. And so I wrote a letter to ANA and said, hey, this could be a near-death experience. Look at Charles' paper, and if this is the case, since we have to take care of these patients, and we do, because these procedures are done, what do we do? Do we wait until the patient has what could be a near-death experience before we, until it goes away? And I thought that was a reasonable explanation, a reasonable recommendation, and also suggest the possibility that since when you're waiting, since there's the possibility of suffering when you turn off the ventilator, but they're not allowed to give, we're not allowed to give drugs that might ease that because it would hasten demise, and there are laws against that, that an option would be to give the drug ketamine, which is an anesthetic, but doesn't hasten demise. And it was a clinical recommendation, which I thought was quite reasonable, but the journal was quite obstinate and wouldn't publish it, which annoyed me, but I wasn't that surprised. They wouldn't even allow mention of the possibility of a near-death experience. So I think I put it on my website. I put it out just as a general thing. So, because that's how I feel about it, because I might have to take care of a patient like that, and I wonder what's the best thing to do.
I think it's so interesting because it kind of gets into this next domain of if we really embrace these near-death experiences as something real and meaningful to people, which all the work that's been done, particularly Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia, is probably focused on that more than anyone else, but on the psychological and life-changing effects of these, that they're valuable to people, then we do medically have some responsibility to kind of take care of people with that in mind. Of course, the larger issue that we just kind of brushed over a couple times is whether these near-death experiences really are suggestive of a consciousness outside of the brain, and whether, despite the model that you laid out, perhaps consciousness is fundamental and the brain is really kind of the secondary player. Any thoughts on that model? I'm sure it comes up frequently with your conferences and folks who study consciousness.
Well, I wouldn't call the brain a secondary player, but I have said that it's possible that these events, these end of life brain activities, could be the consciousness leaving the body, so to speak. Certainly, in the out of body experiences, that possibility is raised. Now, I know a lot of skeptics and critics say, well, if you stimulate a certain area of the angular gyrus, or I forget exactly what it is, you get this sense of being outside of the body. But that's not really the same. I've heard talks about that, and it's really kind of a distortion of bodily sense. It's not really the same. and also the possibility that near-death experiences are just hypoxia, lack of oxygen. But that doesn't hold true either, because hypoxic patients don't have this clarity or calm, and they don't form memory. So I think the phenomenology lacks a good explanation. I've been asked, basically, is it possible that consciousness can exist outside the brain in the case of when the brain has stopped being perfused and the heart has stopped and so forth? And I think we can't rule it out. I think it's possible, because in the model that Penrose and I developed, and I should say this is my speculation. Roger wouldn't go there, but I would just say that since consciousness is happening, it seems to us, at the level of space-time geometry, the most fundamental level of the universe, or at least down to that level, in the brain, in and around the microtubules, right now, while we're conscious, while we're talking. If that's the case, then when the brain stops functioning, some of this quantum information might not be lost or dissipated or destroyed, but could persist in some way in this fundamental level of space-time geometry, which it seems is non-local and something like holographic, repeating in scale and distances, and persist perhaps even indefinitely at a finer scale, which would be a higher frequency, smaller scale, but also lower energy, and could exist somewhat indefinitely. And I've been interviewed a couple times recently about cases of reincarnation where the evidence was pretty compelling. That there's no way that, for example, a child could know details about a World War II pilot who died 40 years previously across the world, but knew things that were shockingly revealing. And, of course, there's endless accounts of this sort of thing. So they've been written off in the past because, well, there's no possible way that could occur. But here's a way that it possibly could occur. Consciousness could occur at the level of fundamental space-time geometry. When the brain stops being perfused, it doesn't dissipate but remains together by entanglement. So an individual's personality, consciousness, memories, soul, if you will, could be entangled and be in a quantum sense and persist as fluctuations in the fine scale of the universe. That could happen. I'm not saying it does. I don't claim any evidence, but it's a plausibility argument. It's a scientific possibility. I don't think it's... I think it's logical, and I don't see whether it's testable or not is another question. And I think it could be in some sense, but I think it's a logical possibility, and it could happen scientifically.
But in that model, the brain is still the primary driver of consciousness. I mean, you don't see consciousness, if it does extend beyond time, continue to evolve.
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I think the opposite. The counter. To that would be, well, okay, we die and our consciousness is like a snapshot and it stays that way, without changing. But that would mean it's not really conscious. I think it's possible that it could continue to evolve, continue to be conscious and exist in a meaningful way. Particularly, it could even be at a higher level of awareness, because it could be that with scale-free dynamics, that the patterns repeated at higher frequencies, lower scales in space-time geometry, and so it might even be more experiential, more evolving, more conscious in this other sense. I mean, I think that's possible. Obviously, I'm speculating, but I think it's a scientific possibility.
Okay, I understand. So in this speculation, we don't have to speculate as to the means for the mechanism for this consciousness continuing or the higher level or anything like that. You're just saying, conceptually, you could kind of see where some of those pieces could fall into place and consciousness could continue. And
I don't think we could rule it out. I know that if you look at the brain and is producing consciousness strictly by classical computing and emergence, then there's no way. But if you consider consciousness, but that model can't explain a lot of normal everyday features about consciousness. For example, why we have experience, the binding problem, global synchrony in the brain, which is difficult to explain by normal neuronal firings, real-time conscious perception. If you take the classical approach and don't consider quantum explanations, then you're left with that consciousness is an epiphenomenal illusion that happens after causal action, lacks any causal effect at all, and it's pretty pathetic, actually, to have a consciousness that way. So near death and out of body and all this other stuff aside, just to have the kind of consciousness we think we have, I think we need quantum effects.
Okay, next I want to take you the one final side note here. If the, maybe you could pick this up and explain it for me. I saw just a snippet of an interview where you made reference to Richard Davidson's work at the University of Wisconsin into how time is both perceived and maybe actually physically happening inside the brain. Can you maybe pick up on that and tell me what your thought is on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, ask the question, what is consciousness a continuum or is it a sequence of discrete events? And I think there's a lot of evidence that consciousness is a sequence of discrete events. It appears continuous, but just like if we see a movie or a video, it appears continuous, but it's actually a sequence of discrete frames. And I think consciousness is also a sequence of discrete frames. William James talked about this, although he vacillated on it. But if you go back to the Buddhist texts, and I've documented this in a couple of papers, thousands of years ago, meditators were able to count flickerings in the nothingness that they achieved and somehow counted, I think, 6.5 million in a 24-hour period, where if you do the math, turns out to be right in the high gamma synchrony frequency range, something like 75 hertz or 80 hertz, something like that. Anyway, gamma synchrony, 30 to 90 hertz, let's just say 40 hertz, which is typical, is the best marker of consciousness, the best correlate of consciousness, and suggests that there are 40 frames per second in our consciousness. Now, we don't notice the gaps, but 40 frames. Now, the Tibetan monks that the Dalai Lama selected and sent to Davidson's lab, when they meditated, they went to like 80 to 100 gamma synchrony, 80 to 100 conscious moments per second. And there's a lot of lore about the fact that when you're excited, let's say you're in a car accident, the car is spinning, that the outside world slows down. Or Michael Jordan, when asked why he was such a good basketball player, says, well, when I'm playing well, the defense is in slow motion. Which means that under altered states, when we're excited or are enlightened even in the monks' framework, that our perception of the outside, we're having more conscious moments per time. So we go from 40 to 80, for example, and the outside world then appears slower to us because we're having more conscious moments per second, which means the outside world, going at its normal rate, appears slower. And this is consistent with a lot of phenomenology about it being in the flow and time slows down and this and that. And when you meditate, that happens, and I think when you go to a higher frequency of conscious moments per second, the outside world would appear slower.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, now we need to get you out of here so you can go watch the NCAA tournament there in Tucson.
I'm in full-blown March Madness.
Tell us real quickly what else is going on with you and there at the university and any other projects you might have going on.
Well, first of all, our Center for Consciousness Studies is sponsoring the Tour de Science of Consciousness 2011 in Stockholm, Sweden. It's going to be fantastic. We have Roger Penrose will be there, Luc Montagnier, Nobel laureate, talking about some very controversial stuff, the latest and greatest in theories about neuroscience, theories about the brain, particularly with electromagnetic field theories, that the electromagnetic field itself may be conscious, or it may be the conscious vehicle. These theories have been around for a while. Now there's evidence. So we're going to have talks by the people who have been saying this for years, as well as those talking about recent evidence for feedback, the brain's electromagnetic field feeding back on itself, influencing neurons. David McCormick from Yale will talk about that. Also, Rafi Malek and Dietmar Plenz talking about massively coherent excitations in the brain. And we're going to have a session along those lines on transcranial therapies, which I think is some really interesting stuff. It's a variety of non-invasive modalities applying magnetic fields to the scalp, getting effects on consciousness and neural activity, electric fields. Alan Snyder from Center of the Mind in Australia talking about applied electric fields revealing intrinsic savant skills that may be in all of us, and also transcranial ultrasound effects, which turn out to have effects on cognition and consciousness. I'm most interested in this, in the latter, the ultrasound. In fact, we have a study going at the University of Arizona on transcranial ultrasound, where you take the same sort of ultrasound that's used for fetal imaging and various imaging in medicine. We use it for nerve blocks and vascular access and anesthesia, and actually using that energy as a therapy in the brain. And we're looking at it in chronic pain patients, but other people have been looking at it for traumatic brain injury, for depression, for autism, for all kinds of stuff. And the only there was a study just recently on blocking essential tremor. And I think the mechanism of the ultrasound, which is vibrations in the 20,000 up to several megahertz, is actually through vibrations of microtubules. Now, a lot of people working in the field don't have a clue as to what the mechanism is. They're discussing it. It turns out the microtubules have resonances in the kilohertz to megahertz range, and I think the ultrasound is stimulating these microtubules and having effects on consciousness. So that's a research area that we'll be working in the next few years, I'm sure.
Wow. A lot to chew on there. What's the date for the conference?
May 3rd through 7th. I should also mention that Deepak Chopra will be there. He'll be giving a workshop just before the conference, and also participating in a plenary session on consciousness in the universe with Leonard Mlodinow, who co-wrote the book with Stephen Hawking on grand design. They got a lot of controversy in press. And with Deepak, and also Paolo Zizi, who has an astrophysicist talking about consciousness in the early universe. And this mixed in with several sessions on backward time effects in the brain and microtubules, of course, and quantum effects, but also things about flow in the brain and other other approaches that are more in the mainstream. So it's going to be a very interesting, interdisciplinary, high-level, rigorous conference in a great setting. It's at the Ala Magna Hall, where they give out the Nobel Prizes, and a very elegant setting. And we're going to have the www.consciousness.arizona.edu is the website for our center, which has all the information about the conference. And, you know, we've been doing these conferences since 1994. And, you know, I started doing them, and Dave Chalmers joined in, and a number of other people. And we keep doing it because it's, you know, it's my way of bringing what I think is the most interesting stuff on this field into one place so I can learn and everybody else can learn. And, you know, I have my own agenda. There's no question about that. But this is not just my stuff. This is, you know, really the latest relevant neuroscience and cognitive science and physics related to the problem of consciousness. And we will have a session on the end-of-life brain activity with Lakhmir Chawla and Peter Fenwick, who I mentioned earlier.
Terrific. Let's wrap it up just by saying thanks again, Dr. Hameroff, for joining us today on Skeptico.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Dr. Hameroff for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about this show or any of our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You'll also find all the contact information for me, a link to our forums, and some other interesting stuff. Okay, several more interesting shows coming up. Be sure to stay tuned for Skeptico, and if you enjoy the show, make sure you tell all your friends about it. That's going to do it for now. Take care. See you next time.